Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unexpectedly robust voice of the Greek people expressed in this weekend's referendum by a margin of 61% to 39%, rejecting the punitive austerity regime imposed by Greece's northern European creditors. A former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Greece, John Brady Keesling, the first of three U.S. Foreign Service officers to resign in protest of the Iraq War, joins us from Athens to discuss the mixed message of pride and indignation felt as the country makes a stand against its creditors, along with a deep concern that Greece remain in the Eurozone and that a deal must be made to do so. Then, we will look into the president's remarks today at the Pentagon, where Obama met with his military chiefs to assess the campaign against the self-declared Islamic State following this weekend's most intensive U.S. bombing strikes so far around the ISIS stronghold in Syria of Raqqa. Nicholas Harris, a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security, joins us to discuss the strategic confusion of both the U.S. and the Assad regime's air forces bombing ISIS while the U.S. is committed to removing the Assads from power. Then finally, we will speak with Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog and author of The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaign, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, A Direct Democracy Toolkit. He joins us to discuss the manipulation of the price of gasoline in California, the nation's highest, by an oligopoly of oil refiners who routinely shut down refineries to drive up the price of gas while exporting record amounts of fuel to other countries. And joining us now from Athens, Greece, is John Brady Keesling. He's a former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens and was the first of three U.S. Foreign Service officers to resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He is the author of Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower, and his latest book is Greek Urban Warriors, Resistance and Terrorism, 1967 to 2014. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Brady Keesling.
Thanks.
And you've obviously had a very dramatic weekend in Greece with this surprising turnout and result in the referendum. I think most people were surprised at the 61 to 39 rejection of austerity and a vote of no, which obviously would mean the survival of the Alexipras government. And he's already fired the finance minister. So let's start there. Is getting rid of Yanis Varoufakis, do you think, and some kind of olive branch to the Troika, the Europeans?
It's definitely a sign that the new government is committed to making an agreement work with the European Union. Varoufakis, though very articulate, got up everybody's nose just too thoroughly, and they had to change him. The new minister is more diplomatic, let's put it this way, though he's certainly not, I think, he's not going to be particularly moderate or yielding.
So on the European side, is there any indication? One would think that at a certain point, Angela Merkel would be wondering whether it's really worth it to pursue austerity in the face of what's happened. I understand that they may be worried that other countries that have agreed to these European terms of austerity, like Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, may say, well, how come you're conceding to the Greeks when we've taken it in, you know, we've had to swallow the bitter pill, shall we say, of austerity?
The most important thing is that the message from Greece is clear that Tsipras, the prime minister, has a vote of confidence from the public to carry on the negotiations. And again, he's being very conciliatory. The meeting of the party leaders today came out with a statement that made fully clear that their goal is an agreement with Europe. And the extreme language of the referendum, they are hoping that Europe will forget. And this is the danger. There are plenty of people in Brussels who concluded from the rhetoric of the referendum campaign that Greece did not need their stinking money, And, of course, Greece does need their money. So there has to be a negotiation, but there's going to be a lot of people attempting to use the referendum as an excuse to sit and do nothing and let Greece flounder for some more.
Well, wasn't the language of the referendum essentially specious? I mean, it didn't make any sense whether you voted yes or no, did it? I mean, it was the strangest referendum. It just, the implications of it are clear. A yes vote would have been the end of Syriza, but in terms of the actual text of the referendum, it's largely indecipherable.
Yes, the referendum was designed so that it was very hard to vote yes. Either you vote yes for an agreement that was not a very good agreement that didn't exist, whereas if you voted no, you simply said, I am a loyal, proud Greek, and I want my rights. And that's what they got. And it's very good that it was such a clear message. My fear was that it would be closer to 50-50, and the yes and the no sides would then tie each other and tie themselves in knots, fighting over the meaning of the process.
So this is a vote, essentially, of Greek pride, that we're just not going to take it anymore, and enough already. But at the same time, everybody that voted no, I understand, or most people who voted no, actually have real reservations about the consequences, and they don't want to get out of the euro. So it was an interesting, if not courageous, vote, wasn't it?
Yes. The only people who knew what they wanted were the Communist Party of Greece, which handed out an alternate ballot that they wanted you to cast, which said, no, we want out of the euro and out of other things. But that's the invalidated ballots was about 5%, which is high, which means the communists did have some support there. But fundamentally, 90% of Greeks want to stay with the euro, want to be part of the European process.
So in terms of diplomacy's lessons, isn't this really all about a total failure in diplomacy? I mean, when you have two Nobel laureates in economics, Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz, saying that this has nothing to do with economics, it doesn't make any sense what's going on in terms of economics, it's all about politics. But it's also all about a failure of diplomacy, isn't it?
It's about the fact that politics trumps economics. And the fundamental issue, though, is there is too much history in the Greek case, too much failure of economic policy over the decades. And so people essentially lost faith in technocratic solutions to the problem and, you know, went down the path of essentially moralizing solutions. The Greeks have been given plenty of money and they wasted it. Why give them more? Versus Greece is too important to be left to go down the toilet. And there is a middle ground that has to be found that European taxpayers will agree to support. And that's hard. Mrs. Merkel is not a hardliner because she's mean. She's a hardliner because the German population genuinely is suspicious of giving money to foreigners who have in the past tended to waste it.
Well, but what the German people aren't told is that Greece's recession equals their surplus. I mean, they have been the beneficiaries of the euro, and their extraordinary export economy has been boosted so much by the European Union, which they dominate. So, I mean, I think all of those sort of veiled racist things about the division between the North and the South, the hardworking Protestants in the North and the lazy Southerners, is completely untrue, and it misses the whole point, doesn't it? There have been winners and losers in the euro for various structural reasons, and Germany is the winner.
Germany is the winner, and there are complicated reasons for that, some of them cultural, some of them political. But it is definitely true that Greece has made a series of limp policy decisions on economic issues. Getting into the Eurozone was a gamble for them, and it was a gamble they had not thought out properly. And former Prime Minister Tsimides had warned them before they entered that the single currency would be a disaster for Greece unless Greece massively increased its productivity. And Greece did not massively increase its productivity. In fact, its productivity went down compared to other EU member states. And you know, we have to avoid the racist arguments, the moralizing arguments, but the European Union, for complicated political reasons, allowed Greece to borrow more money than it should have and did not supervise how that money was used. And, you know, it could not supervise because of the internal rules of the EU are very much that each state decides its destiny. In the case of some of the southern European countries, that was a gamble that failed.
But in terms of this sort of quasi-religion of austerity, where do you think that stands today? Is Angela Merkel having second thoughts?
I think austerity is the wrong word. The right word is balancing your budget with the minimum amount of additional financing from Europe, because the amount of extra money from Europe is going to be small in any case. And in terms of growth, I think most economists will agree that spending all of your tax revenue to pay civil servants to sit and drink coffee is not the most effective way to get growth. You need to pay suppliers. You need to, you know, promote public investments. You need to promote the private sector, which in the case of Greece means when you have private sector suppliers to the state, you have to pay them because otherwise they go bankrupt. And there is no mechanism in Greece now for allocating Greece's limited resources most effectively for growth. So the Greek proposal is give us lots more money so we will not have to make difficult choices. That's not going to happen. They will need to cut back on the state to some degree, especially the parts of the state that are not only parasitic, but even counterproductive. And I can cite lots of examples. That's hard. Ideologically, it's almost impossible for Tsipras, but in Greece's case, it's going to have to happen.
But in terms of pensions and the failure to pay taxes, my understanding is that Tsipras made some last-minute concessions, but he also lobbied the Swiss to give him access to what's estimated to be about $100 billion in hidden, untaxed money from wealthy Greeks. And, of course, the Swiss refused. And I think one of the people in the Troika that's, you know, putting the screws on Greece is also represents Luxembourg, which is obviously, like Switzerland, is basically a country run by bankers and barely a country to begin with. So, I mean, that seems somewhat hypocritical that Tsipras can't. We've spoken before about the idea that if you really go after the untaxed money of the super rich, they'll just sail their yachts to another country.
Yes, the money in Switzerland is fair game, and certain governments have been relatively effective with the Swiss in squeezing some of it loose. The Greek state, deliberately or out of incompetence, there's a disagreement here, has been one of the laggards in that. Failing to use the legal mechanisms that exist already to get information about bank loans, and they were handed this huge list of people with Swiss bank accounts. They've been dithering with it for years now, in all governments, but this one hasn't done any better. Greece will have to collect taxes, and frankly, the smartest thing to do would be to stop giving people cash at all, but force them to use plastic. And that's deeply counter to the Greek way of doing things, which is cash-based. But it's cash-based because you don't want the state knowing what you're doing. But in this case, the state needs the revenue, and they should not be printing drachmas, they should not be flying in euros, they should simply be saying, if you don't have plastic, you're not going to buy anything.
But I think that, you know, I remember spending time in Greece. In fact, I was in Greece at the time the colonels took over, and there was that famous referendum, yes or no, and of course in this case, nay, yes, was what the colonels wanted. And everywhere there was, even on your gas bill, you had, it said vote yes. And I remember seeing the election itself where they had armed soldiers sitting next to the box that you'd put no in. And you'd pick up a piece of paper that was printed in the Greek colors, white and blue, that says yes, and in beautiful sort of embossed printing. And then on the no box, it was like on tacky black and white newsprint, you know. And if you put the no vote in the box, you were obviously going to be, your name was going to be recorded. And needless to say, the colonels got a huge yes vote. But from spending time in Greece, I know every Greek has a huge wad of cash in their pockets. It's hilarious how thick their wallets are.
Yes, but the one really important thing to remember about stealing an election is a stolen election does not give you legitimacy to govern, and the colonels found that out. And Greece has always been, well, not always, but mostly been pretty fair with its elections, and the winner does have the legitimacy needed to run the country, and let's hope it stays that way. There were some rumors about the referendum, but they seem to have not been true. But yeah, the cash economy, I mean, the cash is a huge loan to the European Central Bank. I mean, this it's crazy that Greeks are putting their resources in, you know, 100 and 500 euro notes rather than in interest-bearing accounts or productive investments.
And we don't know when the more money's going to come, right? Liquidity has been, the tap's been turned off.
Yeah, the European Central Bank is very skeptical about giving more liquidity until there's an end point in the current stagnation. So they want to see, you know, a clear, viable Greek proposal in the appropriate forum, you know, moving ahead before they make any decisions on this. And if they simply do nothing, Greece runs out of cash very soon. Obviously, people can take it out from under the mattress, and maybe they should be forced to, but there are enough people who do not have cash under the mattress that it will be a significant hardship for them.
Well, John Brady Kiesling, I thank you very much for joining us here. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with John Brady Kiesling. He's a former political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He was the first of three U.S. Foreign Service officers to resign in protest of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And he's the author of Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. And his latest book is Greek Urban Warriors, Resistance and Terrorism, 1967 to 2014. And he joined us from Athens, Greece. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the president's remarks today at the Pentagon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who is a Middle East researcher at the Center for New America Security, with extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And the president made a rare trip to the Pentagon today, where he met with Pentagon officials over the war against the self-declared Islamic State. And my understanding is that over the weekend, there were extensive bombing campaign. In fact, the biggest bombing campaign so far against the Islamic State took place in and around Raqqa, which is, I guess, their capital in Syria.
Yes, it did. And the bombing campaign against ISIS, particularly in Syria, is interesting because it supports an ongoing armed opposition campaign against ISIS, particularly in northern Syria near the Turkish-Syrian border and Raqqa governorate. And this ongoing operation is interesting because it prominently features Syrian Kurdish armed groups under the People's Protection Units, that have ties to the PKK politically, but also more moderate Arab-led Free Syrian Army groups, many of whom have rank and file that were originally from areas of Syria in Deir al-Zor Governorate, which is on the Syrian-Iraqi border, and Raqqa Governorate, that were displaced by ISIS. And this ongoing campaign has thus far been the most successful U.S.-backed effort against ISIS on the ground inside Syria.
But meanwhile, ISIS is making gains against the Assad regime, and of course they've occupied the ancient Roman city of Palmyra, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. They've executed people in front of the Roman ruins, and they've blown up some. I guess they've blown up the lion statue. Of course, the lion in Arabic is Assad. I can see why they did that. Give us an update on whether that World Heritage Site is about to be destroyed.
It seems at this stage that ISIS has focused primarily on destroying shrines, particularly Sufi shrines that have been built around the site of Palmyra. But at this point, it has refrained from actually targeting any of the extensive ancient ruins. Now, whether ISIS intends to destroy these ruins at a later date, or whether it intends to use its possession of these ruins as a bargaining chip is unknown. What is interesting is generally when ISIS has the opportunity, particularly in Iraq but also in Syria, to destroy ancient sites that were considered of great archaeological importance from ancient civilizations that predated Islam, they have taken that opportunity. So the fact that ISIS has refrained from destroying Palmyra is interesting. It may also be part of a calculation on the organization's part that it can profit from looting the site of Palmyra with smaller artifacts that can be more easily sold and distributed through the international black market for antiquities, could be used as a bargaining chip, or it could also be a result of the fact that the organization is consciously decided not to destroy the site because of the type of international outcry that would result. Around the time of ISIS's seizure of Palmyra in the middle of May of this year, there was a great deal of international attention focused on that and consternation to the point where many in the Syrian opposition were frustrated by the fact that more international attention was being paid to ISIS potentially destroying the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Palmyra than was being paid to the daily destruction of Syrian infrastructure and the daily deaths of Syrians, particularly civilians, both by the Assad regime through its barrel bombing campaign and also through the war itself and through the conflict.
Well, just in terms of ISIS funding itself, you were mentioning through the black market sale of antiquities, they also sell oil, etc. At the Pentagon today, President Obama went out of his way to criticize the Senate Republicans for not confirming Adam Zubin, who is President Obama's nominee to be the Treasury Undersecretary responsible for choking off funding for the Islamic State. And the president went on to say, if Congress really wants to help in this effort against the Islamic State, it can confirm Adam Zubin. So how much is the strategy of cutting their money off as opposed to dropping bombs on them working?
I think it's difficult. I think it's difficult to measure the degree to which it's working because so much of ISIS's income in terms of selling antiquities or, for example, selling oil in the black market, is difficult to know with certainty. But in the specific case of Kanoff, its illicit finance, and in terms of the overall strategy, you know, a lot of the monitoring that occurs has to happen at the ground level, and it's also incumbent upon the nations in the region, whether it's Turkey or Jordan, or to the extent that they can, Iraq or the Kurdistan Regional Government of Iraq or Lebanon or others, to monitor their borders and to try to more effectively enforce border restrictions or international restrictions on the flow of either ancient antiquities that have been sold into the black market or oil that is being sold into the black market. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult to target these sort of middlemen, if you will, because of the fact that they tend to operate on on small networks, a lot of which is done at the point of sale, a lot of which is protected and guarded, and the fact that there is an economic incentive for a lot of these middlemen in the countries surrounding areas that ISIS controls to profit from the trade, and that makes it difficult to stop it at the source. And one of probably the most effective way to limit, for example, ISIS's exploitation of oil wells that it seized in Syria and Iraq is to target them to make it more difficult. But there's always target them with airstrikes, but it's always difficult because there's also an incentive for the locals on the ground. And the way this plays out, say for example in Syria, is that before ISIS became the predominant power in eastern Syria, when Assad government lost control over large areas of eastern Syria, local village-level tribal groups would seize local oil wells or would build illegal oil wells, and they would then tap the oil and refine it as best they could or send it off frequently through Turkey, but also through Jordan and other countries into the market. And there was an incentive for them to do so. So now that ISIS has assumed an almost monopoly of force in large areas of eastern Syria where there are oil resources, they have, they've cut a deal with a lot of local tribes. And so there is an economic incentive for the local population.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for New American Security, with extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. And the president, he did go on at length at the Pentagon today about the idea of hearts and minds. This is a larger battle for hearts and minds, and it's going to be a generational struggle, the president said. It's not simply a military effort. Ideologies are not defeated by guns. They're defeated with better ideas. Do you think, it's hard. I mean, any idea is better than the ideas that seem to motivate the Islamic State, at least to a Western mind, because they seem so barbaric. They're coming up with the most extraordinary ways to murder people on television, the latest of which is after burning a Jordanian pilot alive. Now they've put a whole bunch of people in a cage and slowly dropped it into a deep end of a swimming pool. So what's the president talking about there in terms of better ideas?
The president's most likely referring to U.S. regional partners, particularly countries that surround areas that ISIS controls in Iraq and Syria. So this includes Saudi Arabia. This includes Jordan. This includes Turkey. This also includes trying to reduce the sectarian conflict in Iraq that fuels a lot of local support for ISIS among Iraqi Sunni communities, to try to bring an end to the conflict in Syria and to try to reduce the sectarian animosities that have come to dominate a lot of the overtones of the conflict. And it also has to do with communities outside the Middle East, both in terms of governments in the West and also In this case, he's referring specifically to Muslim communities, but Muslim communities in the West and other places, in terms of trying to reduce Salafist jihadist radicalization. But it's difficult because, as much as there is as much as there might be state-sponsored support for certain sermons to be religious sermons to be promoted, and state-sponsored monitoring, particularly in the Middle East, of local mosques and the type of content they produce. In this day and age, it's very easy for people both in the region and outside of the Middle East to access Salafist jihadist materials, whether via the internet, whether via YouTube or via Twitter or via invite-only forums online. And the example that is set by the Islamic State for those that are more likely to believe in its ideology is there. And so long as the Islamic State is continued to allow to function and allow to build inroads in local communities in Syria and Iraq and to serve as a form of community cover for foreign fighters, it's going to be difficult to tamp down on that. And you know, one of the interesting points that's lost in the discussion on the Islamic State is that in the aggregate sense, the entire Salafist jihadist movement, not just ISIS, but other groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra, to use the Syrian example, or its allied organizations such as Ahrar al-Sham or other smaller foreign fighter and local Syrian armed opposition groups that believe in a more militant Salafist and Salafist jihadist ideology are also functioning and have also come to play a very strong role, particularly in northern Syria, in the conflict against Assad, to the point where they represent one of the strongest, if not the strongest, movements against Assad in the civil war. And it becomes then difficult, you know, as much as ISIS has dominated global attention, as much as the fact that groups such as Boko Haram in Nigeria have pledged allegiance to ISIS, and other groups in Libya and in the Sinai and Afghanistan and Pakistan have pledged allegiance to ISIS, you also have a broader Salafist jihadist movement that successfully embedded itself into the local conflicts in Syria, in Iraq. ISIS has come to dominate the conflict there. So that example that is set of a militant Sunni Islam fighting back against the near enemy, whether it's the Assad regime, whether it's a heavily Iranian Revolutionary Guard influenced Iraqi government or Western governments, is there. And that in and of itself serves as a recruiting tool for foreign fighters, and the sense of inevitability that ISIS is trying to promote, and the sense of a righteous battle that the other militant Salafist groups in Syria are trying to promote, becomes difficult to push back against, so long as they have an example of territorial control. And this war of ideas is something that will also be difficult to measure, because a lot of the manners in which it's measured is whether or not there are attacks in the West. And as much as there is effective community outreach, as much as there is support for pushing back in the war of ideas against radical, extremist, and violent ideas, there's always the opportunity for someone that really has radicalized to do something, to go out and to attack local communities, to attack civilians. And when that happens, there's this perception that this war is continuing and it's become worse. And that's where it becomes tricky to measure the effectiveness of this campaign and the war of ideas.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Nicholas Harris, there's something there very surreal about the idea that the U.S. and its allies in the region have been conducting this intensive bombing campaign over the weekend in and around Raqqa. They clearly own the airspace over Syria, and they have some kind of an arrangement with the Syrians. And the Assad Syrians, I mean, the Assad's, all they've got left is the Air Force in many ways, and Hezbollah, and the Russians. But they're running out of manpower. And every time they lose territory to the Islamic State, they unleash their Air Force and the barrel bombs. So the confusion is obvious, you know. We're bombing Syria, and so is the Assad's bombing Syria, and we're against Assad and the Islamic State, but in bombing the Islamic State, we're helping Assad.
And this dilemma that you highlight effectively is one of the issues that the Syrian armed opposition has with the United States and its partners, because there is this broad there's this very strong sense that, you know, that they have been abandoned in this conflict. In a sense, that the coalition is doing for Assad what Assad is unable/unwilling to do, and that is going to become that can become an issue if there's no partners on the ground that are able to remove ISIS. And at this stage in the campaign against ISIS in Iraq, the local forces that would remove ISIS from the Sunni community don't have the political will to do so. They either do not have the political will because of the perception that the government in Baghdad is highly influenced by Iran, or they don't have the capacity at this point because ISIS has solidified its position. And in Syria, there is no force. There is a militant Islamist force in northern Syria around Aleppo that is a check against ISIS expansion, as well as a mixed, predominantly Islamist armed opposition force in Damascus that's a check against ISIS. And there's the joint campaign of the Kurds and relatively moderate armed opposition groups in the north that are they're making limited gains against ISIS and checking it. But inside the core area of territory, there's no local force that can displace ISIS. And so this is going to be a dilemma in the policy moving forward, because it's been demonstrated that an air campaign alone has not prevented ISIS from shifting forces from one front to the other, which has been important to it to maintain its territorial control and to even make gains.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security, with extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how oil refiners in California are gouging consumers.
Get dough is horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest. S, yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. It go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, album shrilling in fear. It won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare. Here, a new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jamie Court, who is the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. Jamie Court is co-author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health. And his latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Court.
My pleasure to be here again. Thanks.
And there's an article in the LA Times, Oil Refiners Are Manipulating California Gas Prices, that quotes you extensively. And I take it that you've been trying to, on behalf of the consumer, to try and to break into this incredibly opaque gasoline market here in California, where California has charged at least $1 a gallon more than the rest of the country, and prices fluctuate, and it's extremely hard to find what's really behind the price of gasoline, both nationally and at a state level. And I've tried to explore that nationally in the role that Wall Street plays in gaming the market. But so let's start with California. What's gaming the market at the moment, in your opinion?
Well, we have four refiners, oil refiners, that control 78% of the market. And this consolidation has led us to a place where Californians have paid, as of this spring, more than they've ever paid before when comparing California gas prices to U.S. gas prices. At one point, we were $1.30 over U.S. gas prices. And it's because the oil refiners, and this has been a real the same story over the last 15 years sporadically, have a geographic fuel island out here. We have a clean-burning fuel that is hard to make elsewhere and bring in. You can do it, but it takes about 2 weeks turnaround time. And so what the oil refiners do here is they keep us running on very low inventories, literally on 10 days here versus 18 around the rest of the nation in terms of inventories. And then when a refinery breaks down, you've probably seen this, the gas price literally go up 25 cents overnight. So coming into this year, we had a very interesting economic and political dynamic. We had the first cap-and-trade program in America starting in January. We had a memo from the Western States Petroleum Association, internal memo, that came out through Bloomberg News that said, we're going to fund a plethora of groups, the oil industry is, to argue that consumers are going to pay 75 cents more at the pump if this cap-and-trade program goes into effect in January, and when we and with every extension of greenhouse gas laws thereafter will cost consumers more. So we're on kind of high alert, working with our friends at NextGen, which is Tom Steyer's group, who's a Democratic activist and environmentalist. We said, look, this is how oil refiners over the years have gained the market, and they're going to do it again. And we had a conference in December, and at that time, the governor and the Senate pro tem and the assembly speaker were all there. And we said, here's how it works. They keep you running on low inventories. Refineries go down. Prices go up. And so here's what happened this year. In December, when crude oil prices plummeted, went from $100 to $45 a barrel, gas prices obviously tanked. So oil refiners exported more finished gasoline out of California than they ever had in any month in the history since they started keeping statistics. Then in January, cap and trade took effect, and our gas prices were extraordinarily low because the crude oil prices had plummeted, and they've stayed low, by the way. And that's why our gas prices should be lower. So then in February, starting the beginning of February, we had one refinery go down in Martinez with 8% of the gas supply. The CEO said, I'm taking it offline because of a labor dispute, even though he told investors in a separate call he didn't need to take it offline. Then we had an explosion at the Exxon refinery, and then we had about 11 different outages, planned and unplanned, for our 11 refineries in California. And that spiked gas prices, literally, starting the beginning of February, up to that $1.30 gap with the U.S. And they have never come down. They go up like a rocket, and they never come down. They've come down a little bit from the highs, which was around $4. But compared to the U.S., we're still paying over 70 cents more than what gas prices are in the rest of the U.S. So this refinery outages were real suspicious. The exports were really suspicious. They were high in December. They were high in January. They were high in February, even after these refinery explosions. They were high in March. They only stopped and started to decline in April. And then right as the, literally in May, we had high gas prices. We had everyone knew these refineries were in trouble. So gas started coming in, our special blend from elsewhere. And that's when things got really interesting, because as of the end of May, we caught oil refiners doing something they'd never done before. And that was using their leverage over branded gas stations. These are the ones that carry the corporate brand as opposed to independents or unbranded. And instead of charging the branded stations, which they usually do about 3-4 cents more than the unbranded independent stations, instead of doing that, they started changing their branded stations 30 cents more than unbranded independent stations, because they had all this fuel on the market. In order to artificially keep the price high, they used their leverage over the contracts at 85% of the gas stations and said, no, you've got to charge 30 cents more than what the unbranded independents pay, and that's probably what the wholesale market price is. That had never happened for more than 1 week in the history of statistics being collected in California. In 16 years, we have had a 30-cent gap between branded and unbranded prices only three times, and it never lasted more than a week. We've had, since June, about three and a half weeks of that problem. And in the end of May, it started to be about 20-cent gap between branded and unbranded. So as the ships started coming in with the fuel, the oil refiners used their contractual leverage in order to keep the price high. And that's where we are. Last week, we delivered this evidence to the Attorney General. We asked her to investigate. We delivered it to the California Energy Commission's Petroleum Advisory Market Task Force, which was tasked by the governor with keeping an eye on the market, because of we all knew that with the greenhouse gas laws, oil refiners had both an economic and a political motive to keep gas prices high. And so they received this information. They had not met since February, when the price spikes were going up, and I found that very curious, and I said, why? And they said, well, because we can't get access to the statistics that even you have from the Oil Price Information Service or the other oil industry publications, because they don't share it with public commissions, only with the California Energy Commission. So this commission that's supposed to protect us can't even get basic data. So that's where we are. We've called for the Attorney General to dig in, because in addition to this potentially being a violation of the Robinson-Patman Act, which is a federal antitrust law that says you can't charge different purchasers or vastly different price for the same product if there's not a vastly different cost. There's also an issue that the Attorney General in 2013 of California approved the sale of Tesoro to Tesoro's acquisition of BP and ARCO gas stations. At the time said that the branded ARCO gas stations had to continue to be the low price leader. Well, Tesoro was selling dealers at these ARCO stations gas that's 30 cents more than what you could buy in these unbranded racks in the same area. So they were participating in the same practice, even though they specifically said they wouldn't do it to the Attorney General. We think that's a pretty clear violation of that agreement, and we think the whole industry could potentially have real problems here for this unprecedented pricing strategy. Of course, the industry's answer is, well, you know, so what? We have the leverage to contractually charge more. It's our business right to do it, and we did it.
And, of course, the price of crude now has dropped today down to $54 a barrel. Tell me more about, though, you made a suggestion here, which is, I think is certainly a suspicion I've always had, is that a part of the strategy for the fossil fuel industry to stop any progress made on dealing with climate change is to sort of punish environmentalists. In other words, to make it seem like, you know, the price you pay for a greener environment is just isn't worth it. And the fact that we have to pay more for cleaner gasoline, and now you suggested a second ago that they're trying to sort of, in effect, sabotage green laws in this state. So what's the evidence there?
Well, we have the memo from the Trade Association for the Oil Refiners saying they're going to do it, that they're on a political level going to argue that gas pricing can go up 75 cents if these laws take effect. What happened was in January, gas prices tanked because crude oil prices tanked, and I think that got the industry very nervous. So what we know about the cost of the cap and trade program is carbon credits on the market are about, we'll average 10 cents per gallon. You want to put a price on it, it's about 10 cents a gallon. We are paying, as I said, 70 cents above the national average for gasoline. We have extra taxes in California, about 15 cents a gallon. Some of our taxes just went down, though. Our excise tax went down by 6 cents, so make that 9 cents a gallon. So 19 cents a gallon is the difference in California if you want to add in the carbon credits. And that's just a hard cost of what carbon credits cost in the market. And then that's not all passed on to consumers. But if the oil industry has any economic argument about raising prices, it's 19 cents to save the world. They're charging us, as I said, up to $1.30 difference with U.S. gas prices. Now it's in the 70 cents range. And so they, when their refineries go down, I mean, literally, these gas prices will go up overnight. And the oil industry has this economic lever that they pull. What's different this year is we've really educated the leadership in Sacramento. The governor, I don't think, is standing for this. The attorney general is I think, going to be looking into our allegations. And the Senate has held hearings on these gas price manipulations. The head of the Senate, Kevin De Leon, said recently from the floor of the Senate that it's anyone's mystery why gas prices keep going up just because refineries keep going down. Well, it is a lot like the electricity crisis we had in California, because the oil refiners own these refineries. Most of these refineries are not unplanned outages. They're planned outages. When you have a short supply and you're paying a premium for gasoline, why are your refineries going down? So I think there's some tremendous evidence here of the way the oil companies have exploited their market position. They're not even arguing, by the way, in the legislature against the extension of the greenhouse gas laws that it's going to raise gas prices at the hearings they've appeared at. They haven't argued that. And they haven't argued that partially because what they've done in the market is so outrageous, and the legislators are armed with that information. Now, we have the new package to reduce petroleum use in 15 years by 50% and to get utilities off the, all renewables, all renewable energies. That's moving through the assembly next. And I don't know what kind of tricks the oil industry will pull there, because they have more support in the Assembly than they did the Senate. I suspect this package is going to pass, though, and I suspect it's going to go to governor's desk, and he's going to sign it. And I don't think that the oil industry's terrorism campaign here, economic terrorism campaign, is working. I think it's backfiring. I think the public knows instinctively this is price gouging, and we've been able, fortunately, to pull the curtain back a little bit on their operations. But the real problem is the oil companies have to open their books. They should be telling us when their refineries go down and for what reason, planned and unplanned maintenance. They should be justifying these huge swings in gasoline prices to the state. And that information just doesn't go to the state. It doesn't go to state energy officials that watch the gasoline market anyway. And so we want to change that. And if it can't be done by legislation, fortunately, we have a partner in Tom Steyer, who's this environmentalist activist who's also a billionaire, who has been contemplating a ballot measure to force the oil refiners to answer these questions daily to regulators. Because if we had a more transparent and open market, they wouldn't be able to pull the type of tricks we've been able to pull the curtain back on, but we're not always there to do it. And minute by minute, you know, these four companies that control 78% market can do so much damage to the pocketbooks of consumers. I'll give you an example. We haven't released this number yet, so this is a KPFK exclusive, but the total cost to California consumers from February through June of the gap between U.S. and California gas prices is $4.9 billion. Californians have paid $4.9 billion more than U.S. motorists because of this price gouging. And it's all based on this very transparent, very obscure and untransparent market and the market power of this oligopoly of four companies. Finally, I think we have some attention among Democratic leaders who are interested in protecting consumers, partially because they want to expand these environmental laws. So there's a tremendous confluence this year with the consumer and environmental movements that isn't usually there. The environmentalists' answer to high gas prices had traditionally been good because that means people will drive less. Well, no, when there are high gas prices, as the oil industry has long known, that makes people less more adverse to trying new changes in energy policy. And so I think we've broken that cycle this year, and we're all in concert in holding the oil refiners accountable, despite the fact that they're the most powerful, well-heeled, and richest lobby up in Sacramento.
Well, Jamie Coates, you mentioned the gaming of the energy market in California. And, of course, what happened was that, just briefly, the state of California deregulated the electric market, and Texas energy interests bought up all of the generating assets. And then in the first week of the Bush-Cheney administration, when they came into power, Ken Lay, of course, lobbied the head of Enron, was the guy that sold the bill of goods up in Sacramento to deregulate. And suddenly the price of electricity went through the roof in California because they kept shutting down all the generating assets they had. In the way that it looks like these oil refineries are doing the same thing, they ran the price up enormously, and they essentially stole $60 billion. I've talked to people in the legislature, and they say the final bill was that essentially Texas stole $60 billion from California, and it destroyed the political career of Governor Gray Davis and made the political career, for what it's worth, of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I've seen that movie before. Tesoro and Valero are both Texas companies. So is this what's going on again? I mean, it seems like the same playbook.
Well, Tesoro and Valero are two of the biggest thieves here, there's no question. And we know in the first quarter of 2015, they made really excellent profits, and their CEOs boasted on investor calls that it was because of California. And these are, you know, in the case of Valero, they took down this big refinery up in Martinez, complained about all this disruption from labor activity, and then your CEO says, and it's their first quarter conference report, or it was one of their executives, might not have been the CEO, you know, California and all this disruption has been great to our profits. Our refining margins are huge out here. Same thing with Tesoro. And so these companies have profited wildly from all these outages in their refineries. Every time a refinery goes down, their prices go up. So why are they going to keep those refineries up? And that's just like what happened with the Duke Energies and the Enrons. You know, they throttled back their electricity production. I chronicled this in a book I wrote called Corporateering at the time. how copper power steals your personal freedom, what you can do about it. And I was there in the California electricity crisis. We actually stopped, with the help of Senator John Burton, the bailout of the utilities in the California Senate, only for the Public Utility Commission to partially accomplish it. But, you know, Gray Davis's big problem, I was there, we urged him to use his power of eminent domain and seize those power plants because we had the suspicions that they weren't really broken, and he refused. And it's a lot like that with the refineries. We have urged that the Attorney General appoint an independent prosecutor to actually go into the refineries when they go down and verify the reasons that the companies have been given to the market for those refineries going down. No one's done that. 11 refinery outages this spring, unprecedented. So these companies have felt immune from all of this. In fact, their answer to our criticism in today's times and everything else, every place else, isn't, hey, no, it's not that we didn't do what you said we did. It's that you guys are just making these accusations. They're inflammatory and inaccurate. They don't tell us why they're inaccurate. And the petroleum industry has never been held legally liable in the past few decades, so we didn't do anything wrong. You know, it doesn't hold. You know, these guys have used some tactics that may be legal to export product away from an area that needs it, so the price goes up. I don't think it's legal. Don't think it's legal under our antitrust laws to change your pricing habits to charge so much more to your own company stations to artificially inflate prices. And that's what we're going to try to prove soon, and hopefully the Attorney General is going to take that on.
And just in closing, do you have evidence that these refiners are exporting record amounts of fuel to other countries?
Yeah, it's public record.
Uh-huh.
We have evidence that in December, it was the largest export month ever in the history of the state, finished gasoline. Now, they argue us because the price was low in December, not because we were ready for the refineries to break in February. Well, in February, according to documents put out by the California Energy Commission last week, record exports over previous years, even though our refineries were already broken, starting to break, and price was climbing. March, we had exports that were much higher than the previous year. In April, those exports started to slow as the price got very, very, very high. So it's this, you know, the problem we face is there's been so little enforcement in this industry that I can say, I think this is clearly an artificial manipulation of a price, and they can say, you know what, this is what we do on a rational economic model when we can. I would say it's irrational, however, to charge so much more to your branded stations and to unbranded stations. And the only reason to do it is because you want to keep the price artificially high across the state. And I don't think they have that right. So this is something we're going to be trying to figure out over the next few months.
Well, Jamie Court, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the author of Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health. And his latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, A Direct Democracy Toolkit. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.